Bantam Doubleday Dell Audio Publishing presents Star Wars, Before the Storm, Book One of the Black Fleet Crisis by Michael P. Cuby McDowell.
Months after the Battle of Endor, Gian Parrott, commander of the Imperial garrison at the Empire's orbiting repair yard at Nazoth, codenamed Flak 15, received a command from his superiors.
You are ordered to evacuate the planetary garrison to the last man, using any and all ships that are spaceworthy. Destroy the repair yard before withdrawing from the system.
There were 9 ships in the yard. Only one, the Intimidator, was ready for space. But there was more than enough room aboard it for the garrison, and more than enough firepower to destroy the yard and the hulls within. Parrott transferred his command to the bridge of the Intimidator within an hour of receiving his orders. 9 of every 10 workers on Black 15 were Yavetha. Nils Spar, master of the Yavethan underground, knew Parrott was trying to prepare for the departure without alerting the Yavetha. He knew all that Parrott knew, and much more. Nothing of importance happened without his hearing of it, and he had taken the information he collected and woven it into an elegant scheme. Now he gave orders of his own. Notify all teams that an Imperial evacuation has been ordered. Execute the primary plan without delay. It is our day for retribution. Our blood is in those vessels, and they will be ours. Nils Farr and the first commando team entered the bridge of the Intimidator with weapons drawn, knowing exactly which stations would be occupied. He shouted no warnings, demanded no surrender. He simply walked briskly across the deck toward the executive officer, raised his blaster, and burned the man's face away. The rest of the team fanned out behind him, each to his own assigned target. 6 of the bridge crew were struck down in the first seconds. The others, including Commander Parrott, quickly ended up on the floor, hands bound behind them.
Signal from the governor's shuttle, called out a Yavetha commando. The transports are leaving the surface.
Like a cluster of insects returning to the hive, the Imperial fleet rose up from Nazoth toward the great dagger-shaped star destroyer. More than 20,000 citizens of the Empire were on board the transports, obeying orders to dock in the Intimidator for escape.
Activate all auto-targeting batteries, said Nils Farr. You're all cowards, Commander Parrott called out to the invaders. He had always despised the skeletal Yavethan. There's no honor in killing the defenseless.
Fire, said Nils Farr.
The deck plate barely vibrated as the gun batteries erupted and the approaching transports disappeared in balls of fire and fragments. Nils Farr crossed the bridge to where Parrott lay on the decking. A sharp, curving dew claw emerged from the swelling at his wrist. You are vermin. And he slashed the claw across the Imperial captain's throat. 12 years later. In the pristine silence of space, the 5th battle group of the New Republic Defense Fleet blossomed over the planet Vesemir like a beautiful, deadly flower. The formation of capital ships sprang into view with startling suddenness, trailing fire-white wakes and bristling with weapons. Angular star destroyers guarded flat-hulled fleet carriers, while the assault cruisers, their mirror finishes gleaming, took the point. A halo of smaller ships appeared at the same time. The fighters among them quickly deployed in a spherical defensive screen. As the star destroyers firmed up their formation, their flight decks quickly spawned scores of additional fighters. The carriers and cruisers began to disgorge the bombers, transports, and gunboats they had ferried to the battle. Before long, more than 200 warships were bearing down on Vesemir and its twin moons. At the center of the formation of great vessels was the flagship of the 5th battle group, the fleet carrier Intrepid.
She was so new from the yards at Hakasi that her corridor still reeked of sealing compound and cleaning solvent. On Intrepid's bridge, a tall Dornian in a general's uniform paced along an arc of command stations equipped with large monitors. His eye folds were swollen, and his leathery face was flushed purple by concern. "Penetration phase complete," sang out a lieutenant at one of the consoles. "Deployment complete. Assault leader is approaching wave off failsafe and requests final authorization." General Abbott responded in a strong, confident voice.
"Failsafe authorization is go. Combat rules are green."
Almost at once, a trio of assault cruisers and their complement of K-wing bombers broke away and surged ahead of the primary formation. Their course would take them looping under the planet's south pole en route to the primary space fighter base and planetary defense batteries located on the Alpha Moon. Pairs of speedy A-wing fighters flashed out of formation and fanned out to intercept and destroy the planet's lightly armed sensor and communication satellites. The A-wings fired the first shots of the assault, transforming their targets into sparkling clouds of metal and plasteel. The A-wings also drew the first opposing fire. Several ion cannon batteries on the surface opened up in a vain attempt to protect their high-orbiting eyes. Moments after the ground batteries revealed their location, gunners on the League Republic assault cruisers had them targeted. On the far side of Vesemir, the cruiser detachment approached the Alpha Moon on a high-speed collision course. As drone fighters appeared from concealed launch chutes on the surface, the big ships fanned out free abreast and began releasing clusters of penetration bombs. The concussion shattered reinforced walls like matchsticks and collapsed underground chambers like eggshells. Great plumes of gray dust shot out of the launch chutes, and the ground itself subsided over what had been the planet's main hangar. Standing at a podium and wearing the uniform of the Joint Defense Operations Staff, rather than the Mon Calamari battle dress in which he earned his fame, Admiral Akbar gestured with a flippered hand toward a display screen.
"With the Fifth Fleet firmly in control of local space, it is now relatively safe for the gunships to begin opening a corridor to the surface. Our strategy is to expose well-armored vessels to enemy fire in order to locate and destroy the defensive emplacements in the target sector."
The monitors in the conference hall at the New Republic Defense Forces headquarters on Coruscant showed much the same images as those on Intrepid's bridge, though lagging some seconds behind. The audience included all 8 members of the Senate's Council on the Common Defense, 6 senior fleet officers, and Princess Leia Organa Solo, President of the Senate and Commander-in-Chief of the New Republic's Defense Forces.
"Admiral Akbar, a question,"
Senator Tolik Yar called out.
"How realistic a test is this for the Fifth Fleet? Is it anything more than a scripted performance?"
"It is as realistic as possible. This is an operational readiness exercise, not a simulation. It is true that the fleet is opposed only by battle drones and computer sims, but I can assure you that the defense team takes pride in constructing a difficult problem for the fleet tacticians."
Senator Sion Marouk rose from his seat and allowed the heavily veined air sacs on his back to fully inflate.
"Admiral Akbar, this has been a most impressive demonstration so far, but on behalf of my colleagues and those we represent, I must wonder why command of the new task force was given to such a newcomer."
"Senator, General Itan Abbott has a long and exemplary record as a fleet commander with the Dornian Navy. Though Dornia was not part of the Rebel Alliance, it has its own heroes in the fight against the Empire. We are fortunate to be able to call on General Abbott's services."
Senator Tig Paramus rose from his seat.
"Admiral Akbar, I have questions concerning the conditions of the test."
Leia immediately perked up. Senator Paramus was the newest member of the Council on the Common Defense, representing the worlds of the 7th Security Zone, including his own, Walala. So far, he had been a quiet member, diligently studying the council records that his new level of clearance opened to him, asking many thoughtful questions and expressing few opinions.
"Proceed," said Admiral Akbar.
"You chose to send the Fifth Fleet against a target that lacks a planetary shield, was that?"
"Senator, It is not possible to assault a planet which enjoys the protection of a planetary shield until that shield has been disabled. We would learn nothing about our new invasive tactics from such an exercise. And there are far more worlds like Besimir than there are worlds with the wealth and technology to sustain a planet-wide shield.
But Senator Paramus was not satisfied.
Exactly who are you preparing to invade? Did you build the Fifth Fleet to protect us against a strategic threat, or to strengthen Coruscant?
Leia moved to the front of the room with a purposeful stride and a swirl of robes. I can only think that if you had been here when the votes were taken, Senator Paramus, you would not ask such questions. You unfairly malign Admiral Akbar's honor. Paramus looked purposefully at Leia.
I do not malign him in the slightest. I am sure Admiral Akbar is faithful in his duties and loyal to his superiors.
Senator Tolik Yar leapt to his feet.
How dare you! If you do not withdraw your words, I will knock you down myself.
Leia sent a small, tight smile in the direction of her champion, but waved off his assistance. Senator Paramus, the Fifth Fleet was built to protect the New Republic, and for no other reason. We have no territorial aspirations, no hunger for conquest. How could we, with 10 new applications for membership arriving every day? On the honor of the House of Organa, I give my word. The Fifth Fleet will never be used to invade a member world or subdue its legitimate ambitions. Senator Paramus swept his gaze across the room.
What weight shall I give to a vow made on the honor of an extinct family? What I've learned in the months since I took my council oath, what I've heard and seen today, alarms me profoundly. The Fifth Fleet is a weapon of conquest and tyranny, nothing less and nothing more. And once a weapon is forged, it tantalizes and tempts and transfixes until someone finds a reason to use it.
A hot, humid breeze blew across the crown of Temple Atum, the steepest of the ruined temples of the Masasi on Yavin 4. Luke Skywalker turned his face into the wind and looked out over the vibrant jungle that stretched unbroken to the horizon. The enormous orange disk of the gas giant Yavin dominated the sky, hanging just above the edge of the world as its fourth moon turned toward night. This I will miss, Luke thought. Something tickled at the hazy fringe of his awareness. He closed his eyes, reading the currents of the Force as they flowed around and beneath him. There was life everywhere, for the creatures of Yavin 4 had long ago claimed what the Masasi had abandoned. Collapsed stairways limited most vermin to the lower levels, but stone bats had made nests in tiny ventilation shafts all over the temple's face. And Luke shared the area with purple-winged kite hawks, which soared into the sky each evening to search the jungle's upper canopy for prey. There was an unfamiliar presence, too, but not an unexpected one. Streen was coming, as Luke had asked. Concealing himself by exerting no will at all on the currents of the Force, Luke marked his protege's progress. He moved lightly through the rookeries of the temple, sure-footedly through the dark passages. The last 50 meters of the trip to the crown required a dizzying fingertips and toes climb up the steep, crumbling face of Temple Atum. As Stream neared the top, Luke nudged the kite hawks into the air with a thought. They passed over Stream's head like beclawed shadows, crying and beating the air with their wings, but Stream did not startle. Luke opened his eyes as Stream joined him. I'm pleased. You've confirmed me in my choice. Come, sit and face the east with me. Streen complied wordlessly. Streen, I am leaving in the morning. I am no longer needed here. It is time for someone else to take over the academy. I've chosen you. Those words succeeded in startling Streen in a way the kite hawks had failed to.
Leaving? I don't understand.
Luke stood and looked back toward the great temple. Once the Force was to me like a whispered voice on the wind. Obi-Wan taught me to hear it, and Yoda to understand it. and in my turn I taught others to hear and understand. But I have not been hearing that voice well of late. Though my hearing is more acute than ever, there are too many questions, too many demands. Everyone seems to be shouting at me. He turned back to Streen. I can no longer do this work, and the work I have to do cannot be done here. Streen rose to his feet.
Then it is time for you to leave. Past time, I think, now that I understand why you have been pulling away from us. And I will not ask where you are going.
Thank you. Do you accept the burden I have offered you?
Yes.
Streen offered his open hand.
I accept it. I free you in good conscience from your duty.
Later in the small hours of night, a solitary E-wing fighter made an arrow of light across the sky, climbing from the jungle toward the stars. Only one pair of eyes saw it go. Streen. He was seated atop the great temple, meditating.
Goodbye, my teacher. May the Force be with you on your journey.
Raising Jedi children, Han Solo decided, was like raising Raltir tigers. Cute as they were when young, and much as they might love you, they still grew long, deadly claws. After the children had been kidnapped by Hethrir and nearly lost, Han had asked to resign his commission so that he could remain close to home. Admiral Akbar had refused, but he had heard the concern behind Han's request and assigned him instead to serve as liaison for domestic defense. This meant that while Leia took care of the Senate, Han took care of the three children, the twins, Jaina and Jason, and young Anakin. They had established a new family ritual that seemed to please everyone. When Leia came home, they would all climb into the vortex pool in the garden and spend half an hour or more being carried around by its currents. Then, while the children were off with the valet droid dressing for dinner, Han and Leia retreated to their bedroom for what they jokingly called the daily briefing. It was as much a part of the ritual as the pool, a chance for them to swap stories about their day. That evening, Leia threw herself on the bed and hugged a pillow to her chest. What news from the front, General? Han let himself drop into a Kesslerite lounging chair. It quickly softened and conformed to his body shape.
I don't know what to do about Jason. I told him he had to start doing something physical, strengthen his body, or I'd have to assign him a few laps around the inner fence with the sentry droid every day.
What did he say to that?
He said, why do I have to be strong? Someday I'll be able to go anywhere I want, just by thinking about it, like Uncle Luke.
Han shook his head.
I'd be glad to see Luke remind Jason about the physical side of Jedi training. You know, all that stuff he used to bore us with about the body being the instrument of the mind, not just its vessel.
Leia rolled over and propped herself up on her elbows, her expression suddenly earnest. Han, have you heard anything from Luke? Han frowned while he thought.
Well, not for a long time. Why?
I heard from Tion on Yavin 4 today. Luke's disappeared.
Disappeared?
Gone off somewhere. He turned over the academy to Streen.
He's done that before.
From what Tion said, this time was different. It sounded like he was never coming back.
If he's not going to be at the academy, we could surely use his help here.
As soon as Luke shut down the engines, he could hear the wind howling outside. It rocked the E-wing on its skids and pelted its surface with freezing salt spray, ripped from the waves breaking near the beach. Luke turned to the R7-T1 droid as he unbuckled his harness. Keep the stabilizers on. I'll be back when I've found the hangar. The beach was barely 30 meters wide, squeezed between an angry-looking greenish sea and a high rocky cliff. Just beyond the breakers, sculpted spires of reddish-black rock jutted up from the water. Overhead, a thick gray mat of clouds churned as the wind drove it briskly along. Oblivious to the cold and wind, Luke walked slowly along the rocky beach. He held one hand out in front of him, palm down, sweeping it methodically back and forth through the air, like a blind man feeling his way through an unfamiliar room. He had not gone far when he stopped and looked up at the top of the cliff for a long moment. Then at the spires of rock. Yes. Yes. It is here. He sat down on the sand, cross-legged and straight-backed, and brought his hands together in his lap, fingertip to fingertip. Concentrating on a picture in his mind, Luke dipped his awareness deeply into the flow of the Force. With eyes that looked inward, he found what he was seeking. The sand around him stirred. The rocks shuddered, shifted, then began to rise from the sea and the sand to take shape as broken wall, shattered foundation, as arch and gate and dome. The ruins of Darth Vader's fortress retreat. The edifice hung in the air around and above Luke as it had once stood atop the cliff, dark-faced and forbidding. When it was done, the structure, securely perched just above the sand on pillars of stone extending down to the bedrock, Luke brought the E-Wing down the beach and nestled it in the chamber he had made for it. Once more, he addressed the droid. Shut down all systems, then place yourself in standby mode. I won't be needing you for a while. The last task was to inspect his retreat from the perspective of any outsiders whose gaze might fall upon it. All was as he had planned. From the sky, it appeared as part of the beach. From the sea, as part of the cliff. From the beach, as part of the sky. From the cliffs, as part of the sea. It was not a trick of camouflage, but a simple matter of allowing only the essences of these substances to be seen. May this sight remind me always that the few stones I've gathered will not last. And may the memory of Anakin Skywalker remind me always that surrender is more powerful than will. Then Luke descended into his retreat, sealing the opening behind him. The broad, curving windows of the staff conference room, high in the restored section of the Imperial Palace, looked out toward the oldest and busiest of the three spaceports serving Imperial City. Only the largest ships, the occasional crash landing and explosion, or a full-power launch aboard could be heard through the armored glass. So when the windows began to hum in sympathy with the sound beating on them from outside, both Leia and Akbar glanced up from their work to see why. A bright spherical shape, three times the size of an ordinary transport, was descending toward the spaceport. Three much smaller escorts circled it like planets around a star. Akbar watched with interest.
I believe that ship is using a radiant pulse lifter, undampered. Remarkable. Look how slow and steady the descent is.
It appears the Duskan delegation is finally here, Leia said. The transport settled on the ground, and the escorts disappeared one after another into a landing bay near the top of the sphere. Akbar turned to her.
Do you have meetings scheduled with Nilspar?
In 10 days.
That long?
Nilspar asked for the delay. He's never been to Coruscant before. He said he wants to explore a bit before negotiations occupy him. She reached out and pulled a data pad across the tabletop toward her. Well, Admiral, now that it's operational, what shall we do with the Fifth Fleet? Akbar turned his attention back to their previous topic of discussion.
A trickier question than I thought it would be. Tig Peramis has shown us what we can expect if there is even the appearance of gunboat diplomacy.
Leia frowned. I don't want us afraid to show the flag where it might help cooler heads prevail.
Then I would like to send the new fleet into the 7th security zone. I know of several worlds which would welcome even a short visit from a New Republic ship. For example, the Right Earl of Kalita Prime is appealing for help dealing with pirate raiders.
Good. Very good. Go ahead and put together a patrol itinerary for the 5th Fleet. Make sure it's heavy on tea parties and rescuing lost children. If there's anyone else in the 7th security zone who thinks the way Senator Peramis does, I want his fears put to rest. Waving their ID cards at the scanners, Han and Chewbacca entered the grounds of the presidential residence in full stride and in the middle of a full-blown argument.
I know, she's perfect. I know we couldn't have gotten her into that kind of shape in a year of weekends. So what? That's not my Falcon.
They had just left the shipyard where the Millennium Falcon had been turned into unrecognizable perfection by crews Han had entrusted to make some repairs. Han raised his hands in disgust.
I am not being unreasonable. How can you say that? That's right. Hardly a sound. She's as tight as a new boot. Hans stopped and turned on his friend. Listen, buddy, I hate new boots. I like my boots covered with scuffs, worn just this side of falling apart, with room for my toes and a little roll in the heels. All those noises they took out, that's how I used to know when I was pushing her. How am I going to know how hard we're hit next time we're in a scrap? I thought you'd understand. Chewy, they replaced the cushions on the acceleration couches. Don't they understand why people keep old furniture around the house? Feels like I'm sitting in somebody else's ship. I tell you, I'm going to have to take a whole day to go around with a wrench and start loosening things.
They found Leia on the back lawn, sitting on the grass with a data pad in her lap. Nearby, all three children lay side by side on their backs, with eyes closed or staring blankly upward. Han nodded toward the children as he sat down.
What'd you do to them? Kill them?
Jaina giggled at that, spoiling the effect. It's an exercise, Leia said. They're working on feeling the force flowing through the grass, through each separate plant, without disturbing the flow. It's one of the Jedi disciplines of moving lightly, leaving no sign. She spoke to the children. All right, children, that's enough. Three small bodies scrambled up from the grass and ran toward the vortex pool. Leia shielded her eyes.
Chewie, you look even taller than usual from down here. Did you have as hard a time as my dear husband did, letting someone else work on his jalopy?
Chewbacca crouched down on his heels with an easy balance that reminded Han his friend came from an arboreal planet.
Well, of course, Chewie, go ahead, said Leia.
Before Chewbacca had finished asking his question, Han sat up with a start, staring at him.
Go home? Go home?
Leia answered Chewbacca.
Of course. You have a family of your own, a mate and a child. Your responsibility to them is every bit as important as the obligations you feel toward us.
Tell him, Han.
Huh? Well, look, who's going to help me put the Falcon out of order again?
Han's eyes widened.
Oh, no, you can't ask me that. I just got her back after 167 days on the hook.
Han, dear, the least you could do is let him go back a hero in the ship both of you made famous.
I suppose.
Chewbacca crowed his delight and rushed forward to hug Han, who squirmed uncomfortably in the Wookiee's crushing embrace.
But you better take care of her. I want her back without a scratch, you hear me? Not a scratch. And fill the tanks before you leave Kashyyyk. I'm not paying for your conjugal visits.
Chewbacca gave a toothy grin and ruffled Han's hair. The unmarked office of Admiral Hiram Drayson lay buried inside five security perimeters and a curtain of misinformation and plausible deniability. The section he commanded had no publicly known name. The private name, Alpha Blue, was known only to the dozen officials with the very highest clearances and appeared nowhere in the government's or the military command's data records. The people Drayson commanded carried no Alpha Blue identification cards. They wore the insignia of a variety of unremarkable units, or, like Drayson himself, no insignia at all, and took their pay as quartermaster's mates and second gunners, ion mechanics and civilian clerks. Given that context, Drayson was just a little surprised the morning he entered his office and found someone already there, uninvited and unannounced, with his feet on Drayson's desk.
Well, Lando Calrissian, you're lucky I didn't shoot you.
Lando grinned.
I was counting on your being too curious how I got in to shoot me right away.
I said shoot you, not kill you. Blowing apart your knee would have been sufficient.
Now please, get out of my chair.
Oh, if you insist. Lando vacated the chair with a flourish that left it slowly spinning.
Drayson folded his arms over his chest. So, what can I do for you?
Wrong question, Admiral. What can I do for you?
Pardon?
I'm bored. I go into business, I make a little money, I lose a little money. The game isn't interesting anymore. Someone throws a title at me, I pick up the pieces someone else dropped. Till one day I realize I'm sitting behind a desk turning into you. There's no challenge in smuggling unless you want to go to the core, and I'm too smart to be that dumb. That's why I'm here. You're bored. Exactly. Find something interesting for me to do.
General Lando Calrissian and Admiral Hiram Drayson, chief of Alpha Blue, stood before a large briefing screen studying a holoframe of a strange space vessel. Lando studied it at length before sighing in bewilderment.
I give up. I almost want to say it's Monmari construction, but I don't think they ever built anything that big. What is it?
The Teljikon Vagabond. Are you familiar with the legend of Another Chance?
Lando cocked an eyebrow questioningly.
The Alderaan Armory ship? Of course. Every smuggler in that sector has a story about seeing it, which means that every smuggler in that sector is a bald-faced liar.
You don't believe the legend, then?
Lando sighed deeply.
Oh, I wish it was true. I wish they'd recall Another Chance before the Death Star reached Alderaan. But it's just another shaggy ghost ship story.
Drayson reached out and tapped the surface of the screen.
I agree. But this is a real ghost ship. Probably the one that's kept the legend of Another Chance alive. This hollow was taken by the New Republic frigate Boldheart 5 years ago. Right afterward, Boldheart fired across the Vagabond's bow. The Vagabond fired back with some weapon we still don't understand, disabling Boldheart's engines with one shot. Then it jumped into hyperspace. It wasn't seen again for almost 2 years.
Bored yet?
No. Go on.
Admiral Drayson turned away from the briefing display.
That was actually the second documented sighting. The first to spot it was a monitor ship working the Teljikon system.
Thus, the name.
Right. The monitor ship took it for a derelict and tried to intercept it. Now, mind you, they'd been hailing it for hours, and not a peep in reply. Then the Vagabond broadcast a 5-second wide-spectrum modulation that nearly burned out every comm circuit on the monitor ship. There's a recording, but it's so distorted it's almost useless. Anyway, 30 seconds after it sent the signal...
Let me guess. Skipped into hyperspace.
On the numbers.
What about the third sighting?
That was ours. We thought we were going to be smart. An intelligence service ferret tried to attach a locator limpet to the Vagabond's hull. Never even got close.
Drayson leaned back in his chair and drummed his fingertips on the armrest.
It's in deep space, near Gamar Ascalon right now. We're trailing it with another ferret.
Keeping a safe distance, I hope.
Very safe. But we're going after it. Intelligence is putting together a small task force this very minute. They mean to catch the Vagabond, board it, and unravel the riddles. Colonel Pac-Picot of the Intelligence Service is in charge. I'd like to put you on his ship, nominally as fleet liaison.
Why me?
Because you think like a smuggler, and Pac-Picot thinks like a colonel. So, are you interested? Want to go chase the Teljikon Vagabond?
Lando just grinned. In the first quiet moment of the day, Han's comlink unit chirped at him.
Han, this is Luke. Will you come see me?
All right. Where are you? Leia had a dream about you last night. She says you're on Coruscant, are you?
Luke did not answer directly.
Take your speeder due west from Imperial City. When you reach the coast, turn off your nav system and release the controls. I'll bring you here.
A long-winged sea shrike rose from the rocks to fly in formation with Han's speeder. As slowing, it arrowed toward the beach. Han strained to make out where it might be headed. Then a hole opened in the sky. The sea shrike veered off, and the speeder coasted through the opening and settled on the floor of an otherwise empty, high-ceilinged chamber. Han twisted sideways in his seat to see where he had come from, just in time to watch the opening seal itself behind him.
Hello, Han, a voice said in his mind. Come on.
Han scrambled out of the speeder.
Come up. There's no...
As he began his protest, the nearest wall deformed into a ladder, and an opening appeared in the ceiling above it.
Sure, as if it would have been any more trouble to make stairs.
At the top of the ladder, he found himself standing in a large spherical room containing no furniture or technology, at least none that he could spot.
Now what?
Keep coming. Walk up the wall.
Easy for you to say.
But the opening Han climbed through had already vanished, leaving him with little choice. He started up the curving wall and found to his surprise that wherever he stood seemed to be the bottom of the sphere. After he had gone a dozen more tentative steps, a section of the floor, wall, ceiling, dropped away to form a ramp leading out of the sphere. He entered a large pyramidal room from one of its three sloping sides. It was as lacking in amenities as any space he had ever seen, and lit by a curious uniform glow that seemed to come from behind the walls. Han moved slowly toward the center of the room, looking up at the apex of the chamber.
Nice little treehouse. And you've done a wonderful job of cutting down on clutter. You'll have to give Leia the name of your decorator.
Thank you for coming, Han, a voice said behind him. It's good to see you. Han spun around and found Luke standing one long stride away. Han gave a lopsided grin.
Well, hey, I was in the neighborhood. What is this place?
Why are you here?
Why didn't you want Leia to come?
Leia wants something from me, Luke said. You don't.
Your other questions will take longer to answer.
Han looked around with a frown.
Now, this is going to be a long conversation. I don't suppose you have anything like a chair anywhere.
Luke dropped gracefully into a cross-legged meditation posture. Sit where you like, and I'll put an air cushion under you. He waited until Han was comfortably settled, then went on.
As you see, I can hide well enough, even from Leia. But I'd rather be left alone. I hope you'll ask her to accept that. I don't get it. Why?
Luke looked down into his lap before continuing. I don't know if you can understand or not. When I first met Obi-Wan, he'd been a hermit on Tatooine for 10 years or more. When I first met Yoda, he'd been a hermit on Dagobah for 100 years or more. At the time, I assumed they were both in hiding, from the Emperor, from my father. But that makes no sense. No, I discovered the real reason while I was on Yavin. Han, the stronger you become in the Force, the more that's expected of you, and the less your life belongs to you.
Well, is this the answer, then?
Han gestured at the room.
Running away?
Call it that if you must. It's one answer. There's another, even less appealing. I'm convinced that for each Jedi, there comes a point at which he or she must choose. When the world presses in on you, threatens to drive you mad, there's only two ways you can find peace. One is to impose your will on everyone and everything around you. The other is to surrender your will and withdraw.
You know, Han said slowly, I always kind of wondered why you drew the short straw, why Yoda and Obi-Wan didn't team up and take on the Emperor themselves.
Luke's face lit up. Yes, I think that's why it fell to me, Han. That's why I had to be the one to face Vader. I still had the passion to reshape things, a passion Obi-Wan and Yoda had moved beyond.
Han frowned. What about now?
Luke shook his head. Now? I don't know if I could do it now. I don't know if I could summon the outrage. I feel myself standing at a cusp. I don't know what I should be doing with these gifts, these burdens. It's the question I've come here to explore. Han, will you help Leia understand?
I can try, Han said dubiously. She wants you to come live with us for a while. She needs help with the kids.
She thinks she does. I'm sorry, I have to say no. My sister has all the talent and wisdom she needs to be not only the mother, but the model your children need. She has only to believe in herself, and she'll find that nothing is beyond her. Which is why the worst thing I could do for your family right now is come to her rescue. The golden sheen of C-3PO's metal skin contrasted brilliantly with the broad green leaves and dangling vines of Yavin 4, through which the droid was noisily making his way.
Impossible! Such arrogance! For all he listens to me, you would think that he is the protocol droid and I the astromech.
Suddenly, the droid found his way blocked not only by Flora, but by a tall, broad-shouldered man in a military flight suit.
Oh! C-3PO fell back a step. General Calrissian, you startled me, sir. Where did you come from?
Lando grinned. Don't tell me you're still fighting with R2 after all this time. You two are worse than brothers.
That stubborn contrary pilotkin is no brother to me. If I had been as carelessly constructed as he was, I would return myself to my maker to be scrapped. I could give you a list of his operational anomalies as long as...
That'll have to wait. Right now, the two of you need to pack your polish and power couplings. You're coming with me on a little trip.
Sir, I would be most delighted to accompany you, but Master Luke brought me here to Yavin to manage the administrative needs of the Academy.
Lando pursed his lips and considered.
Now, Luke's gone off on some sort of retreat, and he's assigned you to the fleet office until he returns, and the fleet office has assigned you to me. If I could have found Luke to ask him, I'm sure the end result would have been the same, Lando told himself.
Coppery clouds, rich in oxides of Tabana gas, churned outside the windows of what had once been Lando Calrissian's office in Bespin's Cloud City. Inside as outside, nothing had changed since the last time he had seen it. The walls and shelves were heavily laden with the eclectic collection of objects that only a rich man or a well-traveled smuggler could amass.
I like what you've done to the place,
Lando said to the cyborg that sat behind what had once been Lando's desk.
I guess I never did get around to sending for my things, eh?
I don't mind, said Lobot.
The activity lights on the interface band he wore from ear to ear were flickering busily.
You have better judgment in subjective matters than I do. The calculus of room decoration still eludes me.
Lando grinned.
Well, at least you have the good taste to recognize my good taste. Still, a man can get tired of the same surroundings day after day. Lobot, you work too hard. You're long overdue for a change of scenery. A vacation.
Lobot frowned. But systems will randomize without monitoring and supervision.
Then think about how much fun you'll have putting them right when you get back. And knowing how much you like work, I cooked up a vacation where there'll be plenty of work for you to do.
The Teljikon Armada, 7 vessels in all, had gathered in orbit around the 6th planet of the Coruscant system, where it would not readily attract attention. The Lady Luck was the last to join them, and the smallest ship among them, save for a pilotless intelligence ferret. Lando's yacht was dwarfed by Pakpakat's command ship, the cruiser Glorious. On board, Lando and the droids were escorted to the captain's office. Lando was unprepared for the man who turned to the bridge's aft blast door, where Lando stood with his specially picked team.
Curse you, Drayson, you could have told me he was a Hortek,
he thought reflexively, when he saw the 2-meter-tall Hortek with bony, ruddy-brown armor plates.
But then Lando guarded his thoughts as best he could. Besides being one of the few predator species in the New Republic, the Hortek had the reputation of being telepathic. General,
Pakpakat said, curtly acknowledging Lando. His gaze flicked to Lobot and the droids.
Who are these people?
C-3PO stepped forward smartly.
Sir, I am C-3PO, human-cyborg relations. I am fluent in over 6 million...
Lando stepped forward.
Colonel Pakpakat, this is my staff. I'd be happy to make introductions, but I have some late updates for you, which perhaps ought to have our attention first. Is your ready room available?
Pakpakat held his head high, studying Lando.
Reaching into my mind, you and I need to talk, and no one else here needs to hear what we say.
The moment the door wrapped privacy around them, Pakpakat made a sharp barking sound, the Hortek equivalent of a grunt.
I was told to wait for an observer from Fleet Command. Nothing was said about staff.
Why should anything need to be said? Do you go anywhere without your aides? And I expect them to be extended every consideration due me as the Fleet Officer's field operative for this mission.
Pakpakat moved closer, looming over Lando.
Operative! Now, that's a curious word, General. Exactly what are you asking?
No more than you would. Run of the ship. Full and timely access to tactical data. Consultation on strategy. And if and when we board her, include us in.
The Hortex showed his teeth.
Do you take me for wounded prey?
We are prepared to assemble an assault team tailored to whatever challenges the Vagabond presents.
Do you have a lockpick?
What?
You said you're prepared, but it's been my experience that when someone in uniform says that, he really means we have little guns, we have big guns, we have bombs of all sizes. There are other ways to get past the locked door. Are you as ready to pick a lock as you are to blow one up? As ready to wheedle as you are to demand? As ready to coax as to capture? We've beaten tricks your people haven't even thought of yet.
Pakpikot's nostrils flared.
Very well. We will work together. But I will be watching you.
Lando kept his mind clear.
We're going to get along just fine, Colonel. You'll see.